tonight on Lost in the Vault.
Every once in a while, a film comes along that takes a serious look at higher education. This is not one of them.
Gentlemen, assume the party.
This summer, fun has a new name.
Coogler?
Coogler!
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 Coogler! Coogler!
If you don't mind if I play through.
Hammer Road Pictures invites you to meet the man, the myth.
I'm photocopying my rear end.
The Coogler.
I guess I have what you might call an aversion to education.
Do you even have a career plan?
Yeah, does getting laid count?
No!
Mitchell D. Hurwitz is Coogler, rated R.
Hey there, everybody.
Hey there, fellow kids. Hey.
You were so close to doing a bit, and then he just gave up. When you realized you couldn't come up with anything.
Not only did I realize I couldn't come up with anything, I probably could have if I had the energy to. But
yeah, we're recording this at like 1:45 in the morning.
Yeah. But also, like, I just didn't want to do that voice anymore. After like three words, I was like, I'm done.
Yeah, understandable. That voice is objectively terrible.
It's the worst.
So welcome to Lost in the Vault. The podcast
in the vault.
Why would you keep doing it even if you know you hate it?
Why do I keep doing anything even though I know I hate it? Why do I watch these movies even though I know I'm going to have weird opinions about them?
Because I'm your friend and I ask you to be a part of this.
Well, you got me there.
Yeah. See? Friendship. It's all about the guilt.
Friendship. It's all about the guilt.
I don't know if whether we should keep recording episodes at 2 in the morning or if we should not record episodes at 2 in the morning. It's like both sides of me are at war.
Yeah.
Yeah, if as we mentioned before, we're pretty much recording this and like 2 other bonus episodes all in one night. Because that's how the schedule worked out. And we've got to do them through Skype because I'm back in New York starting the spring semester. Amanda's not yet. She comes back this weekend.
I'm still stuck in the farmlands.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
South Jersey. The worst part of Jersey. Nothing but empty fields and Republicans.
Yep. You see a Confederate flag every now and then, and you're like, am I in Georgia? Am I in Alabama? Where am I? You know?
We fought in the Union. Get real.
I know. I know. It feels like we didn't. Sometimes. Looking around to this day, I'm like, is this like, what?
So before we get started with the episode proper, it's worth noting that we have a couple of fun announcements.
Yes, we do.
First off, Christmas Day 2019, we got our first fan email.
Woohoo!
It is great.
Someone listens to us.
It's great, isn't it? And it's someone we don't already know in real life. That's the dream.
Yeah.
From a Mr. Thomas Meehan, he writes, "Hi, will you be covering the direct-to-VHS/DVD movies and DCOMs? Sincerely, Thomas." And, you know, he's polite. He said sincerely.
Thank you.
What a nice young man.
Sincerely.
And I said back to him, "Hi, Thomas. Good question. We did discuss this in our introduction episode, but we can get a bit rambly, so things can get lost in the shuffle. We do plan on discussing direct-to-video and DCOMs on the show. However, we won't start discussing these until season 2, which will begin in November 2020. Hope you keep listening. Your friends at Lost in the Vault."
Woohoo.
It is a woohoo moment, isn't it?
Yeah. Someone sent us something. Someone has questions for us.
Yeah.
This is exciting.
And, you know, this got me thinking, and it got you thinking, and it got the both of us thinking.
Oh, God, the both thinking? Then who's driving the plane? So, we got thinking, which is
rare for us.
Yeah.
From the beginning, we've wanted to have, like, fan involvement on this show. and we've struggled to find the right apparatus to do so. But recently, a friend of the show, Sebastian Moreno, he floated to me the idea, and then I floated to her the idea of setting up a Discord. So now we have one. In the description of this episode will be a link to the official Lost in the Vault Discord. You can join up and you can just chat with us and with other listeners of the show. We've got 2 different text channels. We've got show discussion, where you can discuss the show and the movies we discussed, and like individual episodes and whatever. And then we've got casual chat, where you can, like, you know, chat about whatever. Within reason, obviously. No hate speech.
No. I will kick you off and punt you into the sun.
With extreme prejudice.
Yeah. If you say anything rude. So, yeah. Don't
keep this a respectful space.
Yeah. You can say as much stupid shit as you want, as long as it's not hurtful stupid shit. So, yeah. But otherwise, have fun. And, yeah. Join us. Have a chat.
Yeah.
Have a nice cup of coffee and a chat.
Yeah. We would love to have, like, fan engagement on here.
Yeah.
And then, also, speaking of fan engagement, you really want to help this show? Well, for one thing, you can spread the word to all your friends, obviously. That's key one. But also, we would very much appreciate it if you would go on to Apple Podcasts and subscribe to our show, and also especially rate it and review it.
Yeah.
Because positive ratings and reviews will boost our metrics and, you know, get us more seen in the algorithm. So we'd very much appreciate that as well.
Leave us your words.
Yeah.
We genuinely want to know what we can do to make the show better, what you guys think, what you would like to see and hear. And tell us. Yell at us. Do everything.
Yeah. Well, not yell at us.
You can yell at me. Don't yell at him.
Yeah, I'm very fragile.
I'm good. Like I said, I'm ready to punt people into the sun, so.
Anyways, shall we get to what movie we're discussing today?
Shall we?
Yes. From 2001, this is Max Keeble's Big Move.
I'm sorry. I think you mispronounced it. This is 2001's Max Keeble's Big Move.
Jesus.
You can hear a legitimate man doing that, though, in a commercial. In 2001, there's skateboards involved for some reason. There's like water guns and you're being dunked into a trash can. Like, it's one of those commercials that feels like you are being violently attacked by it. That's what this movie feels like.
It feels like, okay, this movie is Disney trying to do late 90s, early 2000s Nickelodeon. Let's be real here.
Yeah.
It's definitely got a lot of, like, Nickelodeon's ethos, you know, the messy stuff equals funny.
Kid power.
Yeah. Anti-authoritarianism.
The kid makes the rules.
Yeah. But the thing is that it's Disney, so inevitably it's going to ring false.
Yeah. You gotta spit shine it. So, yeah. Who made this wonderful, wonderful film?
I detect the sarcasm in that wonderful.
This wonderful, marvelous, fantabulous, charming classic Disney film.
So, as we mentioned before, this is like Disney trying to ape Nickelodeon. And, you know, who better to get involved as the creative helm than a Nickelodeon guy? Mm-hmm. The director of this film is one Tim Hill, who was a writer for several Nickelodeon shows, including Make the Grade, Welcome Freshman, Rocko's Modern Life, Action League Now, 100 Deeds from Eddie McDowd, and probably the biggest contribution to the popular culture sphere he ever done was that, along with Derek Dryman and Nick Jennings, was one of the developers of SpongeBob SquarePants.
Yeah.
In fact, Tim Hill wrote the series Bible with Steven Hillenburg himself. And, you know, Tim Hill was also, he also wrote, like, several scripts for, like, the first season and was, in fact, offered the position of story editor, but decided that he'd rather direct films, starting with 1999's Muppets from Space.
Yep.
Which, we've both seen Muppets from Space, right?
Yep.
So, he wasn't the initial director for Muppets from Space. Originally, it was a man named Randall Kleiser, who probably best known for directing Grease, but then the Jim Henson Company fired him, and they brought in Tim Hill. And according to one of the film's writers, Joey Mazzarino, he wrote a script that was like very parody heavy, and then Tim Hill came in and insisted on having all of the parody elements cut out.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but originally the ending of Muppets from Space is that the aliens weren't actually like Gonzo. They were just taking his form because they saw him as the ultimate being.
Okay.
But under Tim Hill, that ending was changed. So yeah, Gonzo actually is an alien.
Ugh.
Which,
damn.
But I actually do really like Muppets from Space. The thing with Muppets from Space is that it's essentially like a late 90s, early 2000s high concept stoner comedy, but with Muppets. It's Dude, Where's My Car, but with Muppets. It's definitely got, like, that vibe. Like,
yeah,
you know, with Gonzo maniacally mowing the lawn while Get Up Off of That Thing by James Brown is playing.
Yeah.
And you know, them tricking Gonzo into building a jacuzzi. It's that kind of thing.
Yeah. Very different, but very fun. Even the Stranger Muppet movies are still, you know, it's the Muppets. You can't go wrong.
You can go wrong, as we'll see with definite future Lost in the Vault entry, Muppets Wizard of Oz.
Oh, well, that's a different story. But, you know, you usually can't go wrong with the Muppets.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he did those. He also recently did a movie I had the displeasure of seeing, which was the Grumpy Cat Christmas special.
Grumpy Cat's Worst Christmas Ever.
Yep, it was on Lifetime, and I found out that he directed it, and he also directed an important movie from my childhood, which was Alvin and the Chipmunks from 2007. Iconic, spawned a great and beautiful, inspiring franchise of Alvin and the Chipmunks movies.
Which one's your favorite?
The first one, but I like the third one as well, where they go on a boat and get stranded on an island, and the villain from the first movie is stuck in a chicken suit. That's as far as my memory goes with that movie, but you know, that's
all you need.
That's all I need.
He also directed Garfield, The Tale of Two Kitties, and Hop. He also directed a film called The War with Grandpa, which currently is yet to be released. It was initially supposed to be released by Dimension Films, but then it was delayed. And then the Harvey Weinstein scandal happened. Mm. And so, like, clearing everything out, they had to sell the distribution rights back to the producers. And now we have no idea when this movie will get released. The War with Grandpa, it starred Robert De Niro as his grandfather who moves into the room of a kid. And so that kid embarks on like wild schemes to get rid of his grandpa. He's also been involved with SpongeBob like on and off over the years. For instance, he co-wrote the first movie. And then this year he's directing the third SpongeBob movie, Sponge on the Run. So that
and Keanu Reeves as a tumbleweed.
Yeah, and Awkwafina is apparently in it.
Writing are James Greer, Mark Blackwell, Jonathan Bernstein, and David L. Watts. David L. Watts has, I think, the most other projects out of these guys, but for the most part, this is like their big movie.
Yeah, David Watts, he's mainly like a producer on a lot of hip hop documentaries.
Yeah. But the rest of them, this is like their big movie. Some of them have also written for TV, but
well, James Greer worked at Spin Magazine in the early 90s, so he had that going for him beforehand. But this was like their first theatrical screenplay, the three of them.
Yeah.
They also have story credit on Just My Luck. And then Jonathan Burstein and James Greer, without Mark Blackwell, they would also write Larry the Cable Guy, Health Inspector.
And The Spy Next Door, right?
Yep. And this is the most surprising out of all of them, Unsane.
Interesting.
Which is a genuinely good movie. You know, it's Steven Soderbergh.
So, yeah. Producing this movie is Mike Kars. To lay out kind of like the movies he produces, this is his third highest rated on Rotten Tomatoes. The next two being The Fluffy Movie and Malibu's Most Wanted. Everything else is below. And there's like a number. There's probably like 20 more movies that he's produced that have a rating below this one in particular. Which, when we get to the content of this movie, it's a
What's
movie.
The rating?
I believe it's around 29, 30. But he's one of the producers of the new, 2019 Green Eggs and Ham show as well.
Oh, yeah, that was really good.
Yeah, so that's nice. That's good for him.
So Mike Kars was initially the vice president of Mandeville Films, which we talked about in our I'll Be Home for Christmas episode, if you remember that. And then in 1997, he establishes his own company based at Disney, Kars Entertainment. There he produces three TV movies for Disney's Wonderful World of Disney, My Date with the President's Daughter, Model Behavior, and Geppetto.
Yep.
This is actually Kars Entertainment's first feature film. And actually, I was looking up in the trades about like Kars Entertainment, seeing if I could find more. They were attached to various projects that went nowhere and that
like
sound
what?
Fucking dreadful and really just show how bad of a place Disney was in the early 2000s regards to what they were putting out. So here's one. It's a pitch called Birthday Boy.
Okay.
Which is, quoting this article, a comedy about a young boy who, angered that family and friends give him little attention except on his birthday, manages to successfully wish for and win more attention.
What?
Sounds kind of boring, right?
It's like, yeah, Groundhog's Day, except it's your birthday, right? Is that the...
I don't know. It doesn't make that clear.
I don't know.
And then here's Bonehead, which is about a boy who gets his hands on the Thanksgiving turkey wishbone and makes a wish that radically changes his family dynamic.
To what?
These are just log lines. You know,
these sound like boring. You could do anything with that. He could turn his family into turkeys. That would change the dynamic quite a bit.
And then this one is probably the worst of them all.
Okay.
Like, actually genuinely repulsive.
Oh, yikes.
Worst. The title is Rescued.
Okay.
Story concerns the lovelorn teenage daughter of South Florida's most feared INS agent.
Okay.
You know, INS, which is essentially the precursor to ICE.
Yeah.
Who accidentally rescues a cute illegal alien from the ocean and hides him in the family home right under her dad's nose.
Oh my God.
Right?
That's crazy.
That is evil. That is an evil premise for a movie.
Oh my God. I can't even imagine what a Disney movie like that would look like, especially in the early 2000s.
I mean, it could have been for like Touchstone or something.
But honestly, it would have not been done well. So
no. This is like 2003.
Yeah. I'm glad they kept their hands off of that in 2003, especially because they would not have done that good. But yeah.
Okay. Mike Kars would also later produce such films as Good Luck Chuck, which, you know, is the film about like Dane Cook, if he has sex with a woman, she finds her soulmate right afterwards.
Yeah.
And also what I like to call the Gary Marshall holiday trilogy, Valentine's Day, New Year's Eve, and Mother's Day. And also Blended, the Adam Sandler, Drew Barrymore movie that isn't The Wedding Singer or 51st Dates.
Ah, I see. So my cars, when in the making of Max Keeble's Big Move, they were looking for, you know, their Max Keeble. They traveled Canada and the U.S. They talked to like 700 different kids that auditioned. But none of them were Max Keeble enough until Alex. Mike Kars quotes that Alex D. Linz has all the Keeble qualities. And thus, he became...
I'm sorry, I can't take it seriously when you say Keeble qualities. Like,
he has all the Keeble qualities. And he was brought onto the project. Now, I don't know what Keeble qualities exactly means, even after watching this movie. But I can say that Alex D. Linz was... he was already a pretty established child actor. He had been in Home Alone 3. And once you're a Home Alone kid, you can kind of do any wacky hijinks movie that you want. And he voiced Kid Tarzan in Tarzan as well.
He was also the fourth voice of Arnold on Hey Arnold.
Huh.
He was in the last two episodes of season five, Parents Day and The Journal. But no, sorry, not Parents Day. No, April Fool's Day and The Journal were the two Alex D. Linz episodes.
Mm.
Again, tired.
Yeah. So, what I've gathered from as Alex D. Linz's personality, and I guess, you know, his Keeble qualities, is he, on talk shows and stuff like that, he always would come onto the stage with his little, like, outgrown bowl cut, and he has, like, the mannerisms and, like, talking quirks of, like, an adult person, you know? So when he's asked about, you know, what games he likes to play, he kind of goes on, like, he's an adult talking about a job, except he's talking about playing kickball and Mission Impossible with his best buddies. And he talks a lot with his hands and is, like, he knows what he wants to say and is also a little bit cocky, you know. He's very, he's very extroverted and very commanding in conversations, you know. And I think that those are his Keeble qualities. He's just, like, a weird, quirky kid who kind of acts like a walking Nickelodeon cartoon.
There's going to be a lot of Nickelodeon comparisons in this episode.
Yeah. In a particular David Letterman interview in 1997, he's asked about, like, you know, people in his class that he knows, and he name drops his girlfriend, and he goes, "I've known her since kindergarten," which means, but they've been dating since the second grade, and he's only, like, probably in the third or fourth grade in this interview, and he's already had a relationship for 3 years, and I'm like, kid. Kid, you're, like, eight.
So... that's Alex D. Linz. Yeah. Now, the other big focal point of this movie is our main villain, Principal Gingerake, played by actor and comedian Larry Miller. Now, Larry Miller, you've probably seen him in a bunch of stuff. He was the doorman in the episode of Seinfeld of the same name. He had his breakthrough role in as a store clerk in Pretty Woman when Julia Roberts is, like, going on a shopping spree.
Mm-hmm.
has appeared in several Christopher Guest movies, Waiting for Guffman, Best in Show, A Mighty Wind, and For Your Consideration.
Yep.
And has also played the Dean in the two Eddie Murphy Nutty Professor movies.
So he, in this film, plays the crazy, corrupt principal of the school. Very cartoony.
Like a quintessential Larry Miller role.
He plays a character who is taking money out of like the school's budget to put towards a football stadium, which he's going to knock down an animal shelter to build. So
when you lay out that entire scheme right in front of it, it just dawns on me how over the top evil it is.
Yes.
Because not only is it embezzling.
Yes.
And not only is it like blatant like poaching of academics in favor of sports. Yes. It's also destroying an animal shelter on top of that.
Yes, and he seems thrilled to do so.
Yeah, it's just, like he's very smug and pompous, but also like high strung.
So it's really funny because he acts it in a way that's like so cartoony and like high strung. Like he looks like he's ready to burst out of his skin every minute. As he's walking around and yelling at people, his catchphrase in this movie is actually yelling at kids, and he yells,
"Cease!
Cease!" And everyone stops what they're doing.
And he's got like these really odd flourishes. Yeah. Like he like makes these like addresses over the display to the school, but yeah. It's not enough that he like does it from his office. He has like this fake oval office backdrop, and then he wears like a fake nice suit over his regular suit.
Yeah,
like you know, it's like some set of like covering. It's those like weird flourishes like that that make him like probably the most entertaining part of this film. I think a lot of his stuff was improvised.
Oh yeah. So I actually thought in the way he was moving and stuff like that, one of my hunches, which was radically incorrect, but you know, it could have fit in this movie, was that like there was going to be a reveal that he was actually like an evil robot, because he plays it like an evil robot in a way, you know, where he talks in very short staccato lines and like marches around like with his hands tight at his sides and stuff like that, you know. But, and just like a lot of his, not in a bad acting kind of way, but like his movements feel robotic, you know?
And he does like a really good job playing like a guy you want to see put in his place.
Yes.
You know, you really.
Exactly.
Like, he's like fun to hate.
Yes. So yeah.
Easily the highlight of the film.
I agree. So, alongside Alex D. Linz as, the Keeble quality filled Max Keeble,
or as he puts it, his fatitude with a pH.
Yep, with a pH.
I hate this.
Yes,
I feel bad just saying fatitude.
Yes, it sounds like the worst. Alongside him are his best friends. Megan, who is played by Xena Grey,
she was in Snow Day.
Mm-hmm. She's also
a Nickelodeon movie.
In Shaggy Dog and in Good Company. And she plays the clarinet playing, reveals to have a crush on Max over halfway within the movie, girl best friend character. And then we also have Josh Peck in this movie,
who plays Robe,
because he wears a robe.
Yeah. Wow. But besides that, the entire joke of his character is, ha ha, he's fat.
Yeah. Ha ha, he eats chili and drinks Coca-Cola cans off the floor.
He eats literal garbage.
Yep.
What is it with comedies and having fat people eat literal garbage? That's the same thought I had while watching Cats and with the Buster Jones sequence. where he's literally eating out of garbage cans. Really?
Why?
Yeah, bad.
Bad. Bad. Get rid of it.
Yeah. He was already a cast member of the Amanda Show at the time, Josh Peck. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, would later get his own Nickelodeon show, Drake and Josh.
Yeah? Who'd he play in that?
I believe it was Drake.
Oh, that's good to know. he played Josh, and it was his second role playing a character in a in something with a character named Megan who played a wind instrument.
Son of a bitch, you're right.
His little sister Megan in the show Drake and Josh, played by Miranda Cosgrove, would play the oboe specifically.
Yeah.
Which is very different than a clarinet, but is still, you know.
Max Keeble plays the oboe, doesn't he?
I believe so. No, he plays the bassoon. Don't get it mixed up now.
Aw. Damn it. We were so close to untangling a major conspiracy here.
Yeah, so they provide the two best friend sidekicks to Max Keeble and his wacky antics.
Yeah. I should mention that Josh Peck is a genuinely talented performer. He is consistently hysterical on Drake and Josh.
Oh, yeah. Being like the more straight-faced brother, the one who is not down for these stupid hijinks.
The high-strung put-upon one.
Yep.
I ain't calling you a truther.
Right. I ran over Oprah. Classic. So
the format of this film also, not only does it have like the main villain with like the evil principal, but we also have secondary villains. The first being Troy McGinty, played by Noel Fisher, whom my friend Peter informed me also played Toad on X-Men Evolution.
Nice. He was also Mikey in the 2014-16 Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle movies.
Oh, really? No.
He was also in Twilight Breaking Dawn Part 2, and he is in Shameless.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, Troy McGinty is pretty much like your generic movie bully. You know, he just like beats up kids.
No. Troy McGinty is no normal school bully. Troy McGinty has a traumatic backstory regarding one certain cartoon frog who he's terrified of. He also walks into school every day wearing a shirt with the name of the kid he is going to beat up on the shirt. Troy McGinty is not a typical school bully. Troy McGinty is an icon.
I can see. I think I can guess who your favorite of the villains are.
I love this character. He's scared of a children's frog named McGoogle, who is like a Scottish frog.
McGoogles is my name. I like a swampy bug. It's time to play a game with your favorite Highland frog.
And he's just terrified of him. And like, basically throughout the movie, we're not following it, but we see glimpses of his journey trying to like deal with and overcome his trauma about McGoogles the frog. And I appreciate that, but I think I don't know. I also just dress like Troy McGinty, so it's fine. I don't wear the names of like people I'm going to beat up on my shirt, but you know,
I should.
I'll start announcing it beforehand. But like the leather jacket and chains on the pants, oh my god, love it.
And of course, he's your favorite of like the secondary villains. I assume like your top favorite of the villains is Principal Jindrake.
Oh yeah, I mean, yeah, I just like Troy McGinty for personal reasons. I think he's just a very funny character.
My personal favorite was Dobbs, played by Orlando Brown. Now, I just loved, like, the gimmick behind him. Like, he's, like, a typical, his modus operandi is typical take your lunch money.
Yeah.
But, like, his backstory is that he's a former, like, high-powered trader, like a child prodigy stockbroker.
Yeah.
And then he lost all his money, and now he, like, just takes money from children to rebuild his fortune. But he like, always comes in, he's dressed in, like, a suit and carries a briefcase, and always announces his presence by shouting, "Margin call!"
Yep.
And then
he's a fun character.
And then he dodges punishments by giving stock tips to the teachers.
So he's played by Orlando Brown, who is Eddie Thomas in That's So Raven and Sticky Webb on The Proud Family.
And Fillmore on Fillmore.
Mm-hmm. He's been in movies like Major Payne, 13, and Safe Harbor. And he's pretty established on the Disney Channel, you know.
Well, was established.
Was established on the Disney Channel.
Yeah. But, you know. In recent years, you've had multiple troubles with the law.
Really?
Yes. I found this out.
Those stock market tips ain't helping him nowadays, huh?
No, this is actually quite horrifying. In 2016, he hit his girlfriend in a police station parking lot while having meth on him.
Oh my God.
In January 2018, he was arrested after a dispute with his girlfriend and his girlfriend's mother. In April 2018, he was arrested by bounty hunters in Las Vegas for outstanding warrants.
What? Oh my God.
In June 2018, he was arrested in Las Vegas for meth possession.
Wow.
And then in September 2018, he was arrested in Vegas for breaking into a friend's restaurant, claiming he was there to change the locks.
Oh my God.
Right?
That's actually terrifying, yeah.
Poor guy. Crazy. He's obviously... And, like, he came on the Dr. Phil because, like, apparently, manager and friend was, like, concerned about him because of, like, you know, the meth abuse and all that.
Yeah, it's terrifying that someone can, like, reach that point, you know?
And he showed up, like, on there wearing, like, snake eye contact lenses.
Yeah.
And based on a mugshot, he's got, like, a really bad tattoo of Raven Simone on his chest.
Does he really? Oh my God.
It's just a very... And I was wondering why this didn't get more press, like you know, Amanda Bynes' similar downward spiral before I remembered, oh yeah, she's a young white lady and he's a black man.
That's so fucked up. That it's not, you know, talked about.
I sincerely, genuinely hope he gets the help he needs.
Me too. I really do.
It's just upsetting, honestly. Yeah.
I hope that he winds up okay.
And, like, the sources I had to cite were, like, all TMZ articles that, like, framed in such a, like, a ghoulishly callous way as TMZ is one to do. TMZ
does. Oh, God. That sucks that you can only find, that kind of portrayal. And I wish him the best, honestly.
Moving on, our final secondary villain is Evil Ice Cream Man, played by Jamie Kennedy. Now, if you don't know who Jamie Kennedy is, good. But if you really want to know, he was a actor and comedian who hit it big portraying Randy Meeks in Scream and Scream 2.
Scream 3.
Only a cameo in Scream 3 because he got killed off in Scream 2. But he was, like, one of those people in the initial Scream that was supposed to, like, launch their careers, but then through either, like, bad career choices or the malicious intervention of Harvey Weinstein, none of them ever went anywhere. Jamie Kennedy actually lasted for a bit in the early 2000s. He made film appearances, you know, such as this, and he had his own show, The Jamie Kennedy Experiment, which was, like, a prank show.
Okay.
And then one of his characters from The Jamie Kennedy Experiment, B-Rad, which was essentially, like, him playing, like, a wannabe gangster and rapper.
Oh, my God.
He got his own movie, Malibu's Most Wanted, which was produced by this film's producer, Mike Kars.
Mike Kars.
Mike Kars is also the co-creator, a writer, and executive producer of The Jamie Kennedy Experiment. Okay. And then in like 2005, he showed up in Son of the Mask and it pretty much killed his career. Oh. And the negative critical reception of Son of the Mask inspires him to make a movie called Heckler, which in theory is supposed to be about like comedians and how they react to their hecklers, but is more about, oh, those critics are so mean, aren't they? And he also had like a disastrous New Year's Eve special in like local LA TV that was just an absolute shit show.
Yikes.
Okay, so the backstory of Evil Ice Cream Man is that Max Keeble found a cockroach in his snow cone. His mother called the health department, which, yeah. Duh. And now, every time Evil Ice Cream Man sees Max Keeble, he tries to run him down with his truck.
Yes. So this is like an actual evil cartoon villain. But because it's real life, it takes place in like reality, it's just a crazy, vengeful man who is hellbent on killing Max Keeble.
He also has some leftist tendencies. Like, he calls Dobbs a capitalist shill in one point. So Evil Ice Cream Man is officially on the dirtbag left.
I see. Yeah, so...
And then, finally, last but lesser, Max Keeble's parents. You know, they're generic parent roles.
Yeah, so... we have
his father's played by Robert Carradine, who you probably best know as the dad on Lizzie McGuire. Pretty much similar character type here.
He was also in Revenge of the Nerds and Escape from LA. But and then his Max Keeble's mother, Lily, is played by Nora Dunn, who was on SNL.
Yeah, one of the only five cast members of SNL's 1985 to 1986 season not to be fired. The others being John Lovitz, A. Whitney Brown, Dennis Miller, and Al Franken. Yeah. Now, for comparison, other cast members of that season included Anthony Michael Hall, Randy Quaid, Damon Wayans, Joan Cusack, and Robert Downey Jr.
Wow.
Then in 1990, in her final season on the show, where she and original musical guest Sinead O'Connor, they boycott Andrew Dice Clay's guest appearances in objection to his sexist and homophobic stand-up material. Because, you know, the Dice Man character, he played misogyny and homophobia for LOL Irony.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the original edgelord he was.
Yeah. So wait, was this pre... tearing up the picture of the Pope?
Yeah, this was pre-tearing up the picture of the Pope.
So she's been, I didn't know she had previous stuff with SNL. Sinead O'Connor, I mean.
That, like, whole previous Andrew Dice Clay brouhaha, you know, did some, like, pretty much marked, like, you know, the end of his prominence. Because at the time, he was, like, pretty big. You know, people loved his dirty nursery rhymes. You know, Little Bo Peep lost a sheep and then I fucked her. There. Now I am one of the biggest stand-up comedians of the 1980s.
Wow.
Obviously, it's a simplification of, like, his usual stand-up routine, but you get what I'm
saying. Yeah, no, I know exactly what you're talking about. Not funny. Anyway.
So those are the people involved.
Yeah. Oh, there's one other person in the film that I want to talk about, and that is, she plays a pretty minor role. She plays Miss Talia. So the actress's name is Veronica Alicino, and she plays Miss Talia, the teacher who tells Max Keeble that he has to write a 2,000-word essay, and then, like, as he stands up on her desk and, like, starts kicking stuff around, like, she increases the word count, basically. But she did a few voices in SpongeBob. She was in Alvin and the Chipmunks. She was in Muppets from Space. Garfield, A Tale of Two.
I think days. I see where you're going with this.
She is actually the wife of Tim Hill, the director of this movie, and has been in a lot of his other movies too, of like a similar vein and stuff like that. So she was in Alvin and the Chipmunks. She was in all of those, and they've been married since 1997. She was also in Hop and Grumpy Cat. So a lot of things.
That's nice.
Yeah, a lot of her husband's movies, which is very nice. Good for them. I hope they're still happy together.
So you want to get into the film proper?
Yes. So we listed Max Keeble's buddies and then the majority of the cast, which are his not buddies, his enemies, the people that he's facing off against that attack him on the daily.
We've set up the dominoes. Now let's talk about how they get knocked down.
So Max Keeble's father plays, he works for a company in which he has to dress up like mascots for different things every day and go advertise them. So he is actually assigned to move to Chicago. So the family, the Keeble family, is planning to move away. And Max Keeble goes, oh no, what about my friends? And then he goes, I have more enemies than friends. And if I'm moving away, I don't have to face the consequences of whatever I do in the next few days. So, hijinks ensue.
Hijinks ensue. I think that's the basic premise.
Mm-hmm.
So, at the beginning of the film, you know, Max Keeble's starting middle school.
Yep.
He wants to school. Yeah, he wants to, yeah, show off his fatitude, as we've said.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the weird thing about this. It feels like it's written for characters who should be much older than the ones they are here.
Yeah. This movie, it's confusing at what audience this is supposed to be for, because kids who are in middle school are going to be not interested in this kind of movie anymore. They're probably going to be moving on to, you know, more slightly adult things than like Disney and Nickelodeon and stuff like that. So you've already lost them. But then this movie loses, I think, some of its younger viewers because some of the humor is too raunchy and gross for a lot of parents to want their younger kids to watch it. So then it shuts them out too. So it kind of loses its audience there as well. As well as the, yeah.
Mm. I feel like the logic was that, like, kids want to see stuff about, like, kids who are older than them.
Yeah, totally.
But usually kids around that age want to see stuff about high school kids, not middle school people.
Oh, totally. And I think also, even when that's the case, a lot of parents don't want their kids watching, like, mind garbage, you know? And at least a cartoon is a cartoon and you can kind of tune it out, but...
And part of it would factor into, like, how, like, to feel like it was written for, like, initially written for, like, characters who are older than middle schoolers, is that this film is uncomfortably, disturbingly horny.
Oh, yeah, there's a scene where a teacher walks into the room, and, like, she's a new science teacher. And all of the kids are, like, looking at her and stuff like that. And
she's checking walking. Out her ass. Blatantly checking out her ass. And then, like, she walks past Bunsen burners and they all, and like, they light up one by one.
Yep, yep, yep.
And she gives a lecture on fucking pheromones. Who teaches pheromones in a middle school science class on the first day?
And it's really uncomfortable watching all these 12-year-olds do that. Yeah.
So you know what's especially uncomfortable? How the film frames the false love interest, Jenna, who's an actress was like 16 to 17 at the time. And
yeah.
She's playing a middle schooler. And yep. Then meanwhile, they have her like coming in slow motion, cameras panning up her underage body while Hit Me Baby One More Time by Britney Spears plays.
Okay, the Hit Me Baby One More Time part was actually very, very funny to me though, because it happened every time she was on screen. And it happens like 3 or 4 times throughout the movie. So like, it's just like, you know, typical hijinks and stuff. And then you suddenly hear the da da da, oh baby, baby. So you hear that little piano riff and suddenly Britney Spears is playing and you're like, ah, yep, there she is. Yep. Okay. Here we go again.
So yeah. So that's So, you know, he goes in and here's the weird thing. I don't feel like Max Keeble has a defined want.
He just wants anarchy. That's all he wants.
He doesn't even want anarchy until the opportunity presents himself. He doesn't really have like a desire to fit in with the popular crowd, which makes like certain plot events that happen later on feel especially weird. He has like a crush on Jenna, but you know, doesn't like take active steps to pursue it as one would expect from this genre. He just seems like he just wants to get by. And it's not very engaging. And that makes all that discussion of like the proper Keeble attitude even more bizarre.
I think the Keeble attitude is just like, hey, do whatever the hell you want and don't let anyone else tell you otherwise. Just do it. Just traumatize your bullies. Save the animal shelter. I mean, that one is pretty good, but, you know, start a food fight. Do your thing. There's no consequences. Screw authority.
Yes. No consequences.
This kid is the human embodiment of like a middle finger. And until he's not. But when he is, when the plot is introduced, he becomes the human embodiment of a middle finger, and then
rest of the time he's nothing.
At the end it comes to a screeching halt, but we'll get there.
And then some of Max Keeble's like pranks cross the line from being funny to like outright cool. Like conspiring events to like dump a truck full of melted ice cream on Dobbs and Evil Ice Cream Man. Okay, funny.
Yeah.
Arranging a food fight to humiliate the principal and then like putting animal pheromones in his best breath spray. Yeah, funny.
Yeah.
Traumatizing a middle school kid with like his worst fear.
Yes.
With like reckless abandon until he's left a cowering, crying wreck. That's not funny at all. I feel bad for this kid.
He does it in the dark gymnasium too and has like the McGoogles frog. Someone dressed as the McGoogles frog come out and chase him. So yeah, it's terrifying.
Yeah. And I just feel bad for this. It stops being funny and I just feel bad for this kid. You know?
Yeah.
Like, no wonder he, like, beats up on kids if you're going to treat him like this. And I get that's, like, supposed to be the message, like, you know, two wrongs don't make a right, retaliation doesn't solve anything, but it doesn't make that clear enough.
But, like, fuck authority, sure, you know, and get revenge on the overthrow of the powers that keep you oppressed. But, you know, there's a line. When it comes to kids and stuff like that, it is fun watching like a 12-year-old operate a crane, because I mean it's not a real crane, but he does do it. He did do it in real life, and he did drop ice cream on them. He controlled that, I believe. Wait,
really? Actually on set?
Mm-hmm.
That seems like really dangerous. What if that truck fell on them?
I don't know. The hijinks in this movie, other than the really, really traumatic ones, are pretty fun. Like, there's the food fight, which apparently the crew of this movie got their cameras out, put on some raincoats, gave the kids spaghetti and some other food, and said, go wild. And they just did it. And could you imagine being at that age and being just, like, handed, like, plates full of spaghetti and being told to fling it at each other? Like, the behind the scenes of this movie seems more fun than the movie itself.
You can tell this film's like hacked to bits in the editing room.
Oh yeah,
barely any breathing room. Same plot elements just introduced and then disappear in careless abandon.
I kept forgetting about the animal shelter plot, which was like, you know, the principal was trying to destroy the animal shelter. And then at the end, all the animals were being let out. And I was like, what? And I was like, oh, wait a second. It's kind of wild. It's kind of all over the place. With the animal shelter part, though, did you know they actually didn't record that all at once?
Really?
They released, you're talking about the editing room, they released each individual, to keep with, like, the code of, to keep with animal rights codes and stuff like that, they released one species of animal at a time, basically, and then edited them together in post to make it look like they were all running at the same time. Because they couldn't have all the different species running at the same time in case they, like, trampled each other.
I've got two more thoughts in this film. Mm-hmm. And then I want to, like, share a little story of, like, how I first experienced Max Keeble's Big Mouth.
Totally.
First off, this movie, so 2000s, it hurts.
It's painful. Like, Max narrates portions of it, but only portions, not all of it. He narrates in the beginning and in the very middle.
And then that ties in with, like, how it's, like, hacked to bits in the editing room. That's, like, a blatant, like, you know, cover up the gaps in the plot dodge.
Yeah. So he's, like, the narrator at parts where he's, like, introducing his family and friends and stuff like that. And he's like, this is Robe. We call him Robe. Well, you guessed it. And it's like, wait, what did I guess? Oh, I guess he wears a robe all the time. Okay, that's not obvious, but whatever. Yeah. It's a mess. It's an early 2000s mess.
And then, like, it opens with, like, cameos from, like, Tony Hawk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because, you know, again, 2000. And then Little Romeo. Makes a cameo in it. Remember Lil Romeo?
Oh, my God. Also, the soundtrack to this movie is just, like, other than Baby One More Time, it's all, like, really shitty pop punk. And
one Lil Romeo track.
Yep. And you know what? I love it. Yeah. I live for early 2000s pop punk soundtrack. So
yeah. The soundtrack feels like what you would listen to in a crazy taxi game.
Yep.
And then can I talk about Megan?
Go for it.
I really do not like Megan. She is the worst.
Megan sucks.
Yes. We talked about how, like, she's revealed to have a crush on Max halfway through, but A, it's blatantly obvious.
Mm-hmm.
B, it's not charming. It's creepy. Yeah. She's very much, like, the female equivalent of, like, Reddit nice guys.
Yeah.
Like, you know, she's always, like, pathetically trying to get Max's attention. Mm-hmm. And, you know, trying to do all these things, ignoring the blatant signs that he's not interested in her the way she's interested in him.
Yeah.
And then also, you know, she has a rivalry against Jenna, which is already exhausting because of this, like, trend that we've got, like, pit girls against each other. But also, it, like, seems undeserved, like, her hatred. Like,
oh, yeah, initially, no, Jenna, like, doesn't do anything, really.
Well, she later, like, says that she never actually cared about Max, which feels like an afterthought in the narrative. But, like, the worst thing she does is that, like, tells Megan to get out of her chair in band class, which, you know, she's first chair. You know how hard it is to become first chair in band?
Yeah.
Like, how is that make you someone a bad person? It's, you know, what the hell? And, but of course, you know, because Megan's not like the other girls, and you know, it's quirky and plays the clarinet. And
yeah, listen, her character may suck, but she did play a clarinet version of We're Not Going to Take It, and a marching band immediately followed her at the end of this movie. And you know what? That's at least something.
That's something, but at the same time...
Yeah, no, it's gross. It's a really gross characterization of...
But, you know, because she's, like, a quirky female, that the narrative bends over backwards to make sure we know she's the character who the male lead really belongs in, even though they're in middle school and the relationship's going to last 2 weeks tops.
The I'm not like other girls girl who is and is also, like, 12, so, like, she has room to grow and learn and stuff, so.
Did we mention this movie's written by men?
Yep. Four of them. And none of them could get anything right,
which is weird, because again, two of them wrote Unsane, which is really good female characters.
This movie has lines like "Welcome to our parking lot of pain" in it, I'm not expecting much of well-written characters here, to be completely honest, but it doesn't excuse it. That's not what I'm trying to say. It's just a interestingly and strangely written movie about what grown people think being in middle school looks like, which is apparently unbearably cartoony, but not cartoony enough, because at the end the anarchy that the film was kind of at least reveling in halts entirely, and Max goes, wait, but we can't bully the bullies, then we're the bullies.
Because the fun has to stop, because even though this is Disney trying to be Nickelodeon, it's still Disney trying to be Nickelodeon.
It's Disneyfied. The bullies are still thrown in the garbage can, though.
Honestly, the lesson Disney should have taken away from this is just, you know, let Nickelodeon be Nickelodeon. Especially since, in hindsight, Nickelodeon would end up losing its cultural dominance it had at this time because of the idiotic decisions made by the people running it.
Yeah.
So, at the end of the... And in hindsight, Disney's the one who ends up coming out on top, but that's a whole nother thing.
But even after this movie, they didn't keep doing stuff like this, but I think it also helped them lay the groundwork of what not to do. Because then they went on to do things like, you know, your classic Disney Channel live action shows and stuff like that, which definitely, I think, take inspiration from a similar kind of vein, but they actually did give the parts to, one, older characters, and were better written. So this movie was actually expected to be made into a franchise.
Really?
Yeah, they picked Alex D. Linz to be a Max Keeble, because Max Keeble was going to be a character in a franchise. You know, he was going to be his own little thing, but it didn't take off very well because critical reception wasn't great.
I can see that. It doesn't have much of an ending to begin with.
Yeah.
We forgot to mention like the big like third act twist, and that it turns out the dad quits his job and they don't have to move. So now his plan to like cut and run and not face any consequences is going to work. So he's got to like stand up to them for real.
The closest thing to an emotional development we get, or something emotional that we get from this movie that's not a forced love
triangle.
Which is really weird.
They're in middle school.
Yeah. And that is, the dad is trying to talk to Max about like moving and stuff like that, which is an interesting and kind of heart-wrenching conversation to have, you know, and hearing it from a kid's perspective, like a, you know, a pretty, chill,
naive
kid, which is just, well, why don't we just not move, you know? And the adult taking some of that wisdom, which is naive but also in its own way wise, you know, like, why don't you just say no,
stand up for yourself.
Yeah, you know, it's the kid who hasn't really, who's dealing with learning about authority now versus a parent who is deeply rooted in dealing with authority every day and feeling stuck in their place, while like Max is very much like, screw it. You know, I'm a radical middle school kid and I'm going to cause chaos. Yeah. 'Cause I can do what I want, you know, this doesn't matter. So that dynamic could have been interesting, but it didn't really go many places. But it was cool to see the dad take his kid's advice to heart. I really like that, actually. Mm-hmm. I will give the movie that.
It doesn't seem to have much of an interest in anything it's presenting. It's like,
yeah,
beat, 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 beat.
That one. Yeah. That was the one that went, I think, that was like the closest to going somewhere, you know, and had kind of a, not really, but at the end, Max Keeble learns a little bit more about boundaries, and the father learns how to stand up for himself, but it only happened in that one interaction. So it doesn't make much sense. So, you know.
You know.
As it is.
But, you know, nothing gets to breathe in this movie because it's clear they stripped the bone trying to, like, get it under 90 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
How long is this? What, I think it's, like, what, 70 minutes?
It's 86 minutes, I believe.
Really? It feels a lot shorter than that.
It is. Let me take a look. Yep, this movie is an hour and 26 minutes long.
It feels shorter than that, and I think it's just a shitty pacing.
It feels like a television movie. It feels like it is made to have commercials in between it.
Well, that makes sense, because the production company previously only made television movies.
Mm-hmm. I think it could have worked well as a TV franchise. You know, you can change the plot around enough that you can repeat it, you know?
Mm.
You can do wacky hijinks in almost any really basic hijinks-inducing setting. So,
you know what this reminded me of, even though this came first?
What?
Ned's Declassified School Survival Guide.
I have that written down, actually. It really, really does. It feels like the beta version, you know?
Yeah. Ned's Declassified obviously does it a lot better because, you know, for one thing, it understands that these characters are still, you know, in middle school.
And it's very high-paced, but also paced well. And Ned is a little bit more well-rounded than our little spark plug Max Keeble, our little like fireball, you know.
And it has well-defined female characters that aren't just there to hate each other in competition over a dude.
Yeah. So yeah, Max Keeble has some fun concepts in it, but ultimately just leaves it's like a bunch of strings that nobody tied together and just left on a heap on the floor.
So you mentioned this was going to be a franchise, but that did not happen. $18 million worldwide on a $25 million budget. Opened at number 6 the box office, making only $5 million. And if you look at what's coming out at the same time, it doesn't seem to make sense because it's the only family film out there.
Mm-hmm.
But then you look at the release date. October 5th, 2001. Mm-hmm. 4 weekends after 9/11. No movie was really doing well around that time.
Not a big time for movies.
No. So, yeah, that's pretty much Max Keeble's big move. It's Disney trying to be Nickelodeon. It didn't work, so they stopped.
Honestly, I didn't despise it. I mean, there were things in it that I despised, obviously. But, like, I feel like if I was, like, a kid, I would have enjoyed it enough. But my mom probably would have turned it off, you know, kind of deal.
I think I did enjoy it when I was a kid, because I did see it when I was a kid.
Oh, wait, what were your circumstances of seeing it?
Yes. I almost forgot. When I was a kid, I had some medical thing. It was, like, a very brief thing, like, some sort of, like, weird cough thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to take medication through, like, a nebulizer, which, if you don't know, it's, like, this machine that's hooked up to a mask you put around your face and, like, pumps in medicine into you to, like, clear out your lungs. So to entertain me, well, I had to have this like medicine mask strapped to my face. They put on the Disney Channel, and what was playing was Max Keeble's Big Move. And now I think that was the way that movie meant to be seen, in your parents' bedroom at like 8 p.m. Mm-hmm. Watching on the Disney Channel with a nebulizer strapped to your face.
That's a good way to watch anything. That's how I, not in that specific way, but I was getting getting cavities removed while I watched the Tom and Jerry movie. You know that one where they sing and stuff like that?
And become friends?
Yep.
And her voice by Richard Kind and whatever her name is.
Yep. So
Dana Hill.
The one where Tom and Jerry talk, and I had like they have goggles that they give you, and I had these goggles on, and my mouth was numb, and all I could see and hear was Tom and Jerry singing to me. And you know, it's one of those kinds of things where it'll just, you'll watch it eventually, whether you want to or not. It'll just happen in your childhood at some point. Probably won't remember it, but it's fine.
We all eventually have our turn witnessing that Keeble attitude.
We all have a Max Keeble kind of movie, you know?
Gotta have that fatitude.
Gotta have that fatitude.
All right. Signing off, I'm Dal Negatone.
And I'm the other one.
So long.
So long.
Next time on Lost in the Vault.
He's a man's man. He's a ladies man. He's a family man. He's a sailor man. It's Robin Williams and Shelley Duvall, the eye-popping entertainment of the year. Popeye, rated PG.